Hi, I'm Becca. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. Thank you guys for being here tonight and listening to me. So I'm just going to put a little disclaimer. I'm not a fan of speaking in front of people. I'm really working on, and I get into trouble when I edit. That I've noticed that when I edit what I'm going to say, try to leave things out or say it in like a delicate way so it's not offend anybody. I end up just not, the message gets watered down. So I'm just going to not edit tonight. If I offend anybody, I apologize. I like the fact that this meeting is open to all A's, you know, that there's, you know, this is an alumni meeting. It's not specific. And so I'm just going to talk a little bit about my struggle with addiction, which lasted over 20 years, and how I got clean and what has gone on in my life since I got clean. This is the most clean time I've ever had. My sobriety date, clean date is 1-2 of 17. I did go to Austin Recovery 4.5 years ago, so I left there and I didn't stay clean. And I definitely want to talk about that because I think there was, there are some things that I think I needed to have that experience, but there are definitely some things that I would do differently. And if I can share any of that, especially for people that are in treatment right now, I'd like to do that. So, all right. So my life, I was raised in Auckland, New Zealand. I came here to the United States when I was 12. My parents are, I almost said high functioning, but that's not the truth. They look high functioning, or they looked high functioning. They were successful, but they were really ill-equipped to have kids, I think. And definitely, like, they built a really big kind of empire that crumbled like 2 or 3 times during my childhood. Like, my dad was basically like, he's kind of like Bill, actually. He reminds me, when I read Bill's story, it reminds me of my dad, you know, like, just a gambler. It's like his favorite Kenny Rogers song, The Gambler. You know, he loves that song, and he is that guy. So my childhood was marked with huge successes and then weird, like, we don't have any money and we're sleeping on somebody's couch in Mission Viejo, California. You know, like, that's kind of how it was. And there wasn't any conversations about it, really. It was very secretive. I think it was my dad had a lot of shame about that. He also was drinking very heavily at the time, and he now has 35 years sober, but he's different than me in the respect that he is that heavy drinker. You know, he doesn't do meetings. He didn't go to treatment. He just, like, made a decision, you know, like, given a good enough reason, he just stopped drinking. That's not my experience. So whenever I was struggling with my addiction, he would try to, like, relate to me and be like, just make a decision. And I needed more than that. You know what I mean? I needed, it just wasn't like that for me. So with my mom, and I think it's important because it definitely shaped a lot of who I am. My mom, since she was 28, since she was about 28. So since she had my brother, had started taking amphetamines, basically. They call them diet pills. I forget what they are. They're dexedrine or whatever, but Adderall is another, you know. So she was on some form of that all through my childhood. She kind of still is today. But back when I was a kid, it was really intense. Like, she was crazy, you know. She was erratic. She wasn't eating. She definitely, like, suffered from a lot of body image issues. At one point was anorexic. And so there was a lot of, like, dysfunction within my family. And I'm not saying that set me up. Like, I don't know if I was predisposed or whatever. I just think it's useful. I use it as, like, useful information, you know, to, I guess, just analyze and look at, like, where I came from and, you know, and really try not to repeat the same mistakes, honestly. So anyway, we move up here to the United States when I'm 12. I start going to school in the U.S. and I have this really thick New Zealand accent. And it's my first memory of what goes on, went on throughout my entire life and really still goes on today. I just have a lot more awareness. And that was that I wanted to not be weird, different, seen, nothing. I wanted to be as invisible as possible. I just want to blend, you know? And so I tried really hard to sound like an American and it just sounded terrible, you know, but I was really, really trying to, you know, fit in, be, like I said, not be seen as different. So, things went on with my family. My dad was able to like rebuild everything, but my parents were, you know, at each other's throats, like really intense, violent at each other's throats. And eventually, they got divorced when I was 15 or 16. And I really anticipated that my dad, who was like my person, was going to say like, okay, so now we can finally, we're going to leave your mom and you and I are going to take off together. And, you know, I'm going to be, you know, you're going to live with me. I'm going to take care of you. And that's not what happened at all. He left me with my mom, and my mom and I did not get along at all. And I just felt so much betrayal. You know, I really did. I felt so angry and betrayed. My little kid brain just couldn't understand it. He ended up remarrying somebody like a year or two later. And at that time, I had such intense behavior problems, or what they called behavior problems. I acted out a lot. I hadn't really touched drugs or alcohol yet. I was only 15, 16 years old. But I definitely had like angry outbursts and was in and out of a psychiatrist's office, you know, diagnosed with this, diagnosed with that. And I just remember having a lot of really big feelings and feeling like everything was so unjust, you know, like everything is this is such bullshit and nobody is listening to me. So eventually, they did get me, my dad couldn't figure out what to do with me. I couldn't get on with my mom. He didn't want me living there cause I was making his life a living hell with his new wife. And so he's like, we're just going to get you your own place. And I'm like, this is, yeah, great. I love that idea. Just get me my own apartment at 15, 16 years old. But I think like subconsciously, I must have taken that on as like, nobody wants me. You know what I mean? Like I'm too difficult. I'm too much. Nobody wants me. But these kids that I met at continuation school, which is like alternative school, became like my new family. You know, and we had this great apartment to do all kinds of stuff in. And that was the beginnings of me experimenting with all kinds of things. Back then I was exposed to addicts that were using harder drugs. I just at that time didn't touch them. So it was just smoking a lot of weed, taking a lot of acid, drinking very badly, always blacking out, you know, always looking for oblivion, no matter what substance it was, you know? So ultimately the apartment thing imploded and my parents put me in my first treatment center. And, it was in Southern California. It was kind of a hardcore one. I don't think they did a lot of research. They just like picked the first one they found and it was behavior modification. So we were like out digging ditches at like 5 o'clock in the morning. And you know what I mean? It was really intense. I ended up running away from there. And then those next few years are kind of a blur. I think I probably lived with friends and, you know, was in and out of my mom's house until I was 18. And then I somehow was shuffled into Alcoholics Anonymous, into the program, and moved into a sober living. And I think I stayed clean for, I don't know, maybe a year. I have a tendency, or had a tendency back in my, you know, when I was younger, of finding self-destruction. Like if you're self-destructive and you're more self-destructive than me, I want to know like how you do your self-destruction and I'm just going to amp mine up, you know? And so then I met the right people for that and was introduced to the things that I really wanted to do, because I was not a person that was afraid of There was so much self-hatred on board that I just didn't have any concern for myself, you know? And I find that alarming now, you know, because I actually care about myself, but I spent the majority of my life not caring about myself, you know, but not caring about myself, but thinking about myself all the time. Both of those things, you know, it's like the crazy part of alcoholism, right? Like I absolutely hate myself, but I think about myself and what's in it for me at all times. So 18, moved into sober living, met the right person. That person and I moved in together, and he was a heroin addict, but he had like 9 months clean or something. And, you know, I really did not have any understanding of what he was a lot older than me. I just didn't really know about his lifestyle, you know? And for a couple months while we were living together, he had relapsed and I was totally unaware. I was like, why is he so sleepy? Like I didn't understand, you know, I just didn't really get it that he was using, you know? Eventually, I mean, I bring that up to say that like that, this was kind of, if I were to pinpoint the beginning of my descent into my addiction to where, you know, I was cycling in and out of treatment centers and stuff. It would be right about now, but right about this time. We ended up splitting up and he ended up dying. He ended up killing himself. Now he hung himself when he was 32 years old. He was such a cool guy, man. He was so cool. And I didn't know what to do with that. You know what I mean? I'd never really had anybody in my life die before. Certainly not like my first love, basically. And my solution to that, well, I had a lot of resentment toward the program because I felt like everyone had abandoned him when he relapsed, which is not the truth at all. But I, at the time, that's what I felt. And so at that point, I really made a decision. Like I am under no circumstances ever doing meetings or any of that shit ever again, you know? And I, you know, proceeded to get strung out and I stayed strung out for almost a decade. I was trying to piece it together because, you know, I used, right? So I don't have a great chronological order of what went on in my life. You know, but I was thinking about it, like the day that 9/11 happened was the first day that I ever signed up for methadone. So that was like 20 years ago. It was a long time ago, you know, and that marker is, you know, and that's what I would do. I would, you know, get high for a period of time and then I would get on some kind of detox maintenance program. And I would just do this shuffle over and over again, because the idea of being clean was impossible. You know, like it wasn't like that I didn't want that. It was impossible. You know, it didn't seem feasible to get from here. And really what it was, I used to say it was because I didn't want to get sick, but the truth was I didn't want to feel right. So like anything that's going to like dull any of this for me, I want to do it. And that's what I did. I guess I want to speed up my drug use, part of the story. That just cause there's nothing much to it. You know what I mean? Like back then I didn't have to, I did steal a little bit for dope, but not a whole bunch. You know, I still had people giving me money. I still had family to manipulate, you know, like that all happened later where things got, you know, where people 20 years of this and people are finally just sick of your shit, you know, but for a long time, people felt sorry for me or helped me or would come and especially my dad would come and rescue me, you know, try to help me. So as I said, about a decade of using on and off, in 2000, I'll just speed it up to 2008. I met the husband that I'm married to now. I actually met him at a meeting and, you know, but neither one of us was clean. And, we ended up going on a run that lasted like, I don't know, 5 or 6 years in two different states. We went California and then Northern California and then over to New Mexico, just like running amok together. His parents had money. He had money coming in and we just really did You know, neither one of us wanted to be responsible for our lives. So that's what we did. We just ran around the country, you know, from bad situation to bad situation. In 2011, we were both kind of clean. We were on something, but we weren't like as bad as we had been. And I looked at him, and I think this is important because it's something I think about all the time. You know, there were times when I would be clean and it was unbearable. You know, for me, clean without a program or some kind of spiritual connection or some kind of solution can't last for very long. You know, it just can't. Like, I'm too uncomfortable. And I looked over at him. We were living in Long Beach at the time. And I said, let's get high. You know, it wasn't his idea. It was my idea. It typically was my idea because I just couldn't sit with myself. And why that's important, and that's one particular day, was September 17th of 2011. We did get high, and he got on our moped, and he crashed, really badly. And since that day, he's been severely brain damaged. Like, he's not who he was, and he won't be that person ever again. You know, and he lives in an assisted living here in Austin. Actually, he's from Texas. That's how I ended up here. And I guess that's just important. There's so many reasons why that's important, but you know, that was I definitely held on to that a lot. You know, like, that it was my idea, that I couldn't sit with myself. You know, I mean, we both made the decision, but ultimately, that's what happened. So fast forward to 2011 or 2012, I moved out here because his family is from here, and started to, I stopped using, right? But I never really stopped using. I'm always on something, you know, but I stopped using as badly, I should say. And I had no solution. I came to Austin, and I was, his parents just absolutely financially took care of me. And for me, that's the kiss of death, honestly. A bunch of free money, a bunch of unstructured time, a bunch of trauma and guilt, you know, and it's just the kiss of death for me. You know, like, I can't, I figured that out about myself. Like, I absolutely have to be self-supporting, you know. That's for me personally. I really do. And 'cause I've tried to not be, you know, for years I didn't, I would take whatever anyone gave me. You know? So anyway, that's what happened. I showed up in Austin. I was given money and, you know, I could do whatever I want with it, you know? And what I chose to do is find another self-destructive person, the best one I could find, and go off in a totally different direction using a totally different drug that took me to totally different places. And I'm so grateful for that. I am so grateful, for the years that I spent in Texas. And it was, I think, about 4 years total that I spent just absolutely hitting the bottom that I never would hit before, you know, because someone would always come and, like, give me a parachute, put a pillow under me or something, you know, like, someone was always there to fix it, rescue me. And not this time, you know. It went on for so long and it got so bad. I was in psychosis for, I don't know, a couple years. And so my parents were just getting, like, these crazy phone calls, and they finally just had to disengage with me. And it's the best thing they ever did for me, honestly. It was the hardest thing, I'm sure, for them, but it was the best thing they ever did for me. Because I really, really needed to have nowhere to go for me to be able to get this the way that I feel. And now that I am clean the way that I am, and, like, have had to build this foundation and work so hard to, like, stay here and stay in this, I really protect it with a vigilance, which I never did before. I didn't really honor it or care about it or even acknowledge it, you know, my clean time or this journey the way that I do now. So as I said, I hit a pretty intense bottom. But what's interesting about the bottom is, it, as you guys have heard, it has a basement. So I went to Austin Recovery, man, I don't even know when it was, but it was 4.5 years ago. And I checked in. I checked in at 10 o'clock at night. Some Uber driver dropped me off. They don't even take people at 10 o'clock at night, but they were nice enough. The techs were nice enough because I was in such bad shape. I was, I don't know. I really was in bad shape. My intake picture is horrifying. You know, it really is. I literally look like I look like I'm dying, you know. So they took me and they put me in the safe room. I don't even know if you guys have it anymore. It's like the little room that with bunk beds and just, it's basically a storage closet. And they let me sleep there for the night until I could do my intake in the morning. And I'm so grateful that they did that because quite frankly, they didn't have to, you know, but I feel like the tech must have known that if they didn't take me, that I wasn't probably going to be able to make it back. Like I was not, like just even find my way back. You know, I wasn't firing on all cylinders at all. So, I remember coming into the living room at Austin Recovery the next morning and there was this thing on the wall that said, breathe. I don't know if that's still there. And I just remember like collapsing on the couch. I'd been up for a really long time. I was exhausted. I was dirty. You know, I hadn't lost all my stuff. Everything was gone. I think I had like one dress, you know, they had to find stuff for me to wear, you know, everything I owned was thrown into a dumpster in some motel right before I went to jail, you know, so I really had nothing. And I stayed there for 2 months. They extended me. They let me. I asked them, I begged them to extend me and they did. And then I got out and went to sober living. And I think this is important because, well, it was important for me. I was not, there were things I was not willing to let go of when I was there. I surrendered mostly, you know, but, and you would think like it would, like my situation would be enough that I would surrender, you know, like I will do whatever, but I still had some holdouts. And one of those holdouts was the boyfriend. I was not willing to not talk to him because he needed to get clean too. And I needed to help him, you know? And so I got out of Austin Recovery. I went to a sober living and I maybe made it like a few weeks and then I started talking to him again. I saw him, I was riding the bus and I saw him on the, I saw him, he was like homeless, like I was. And he was riding around, you know, on his bike and he had a pipe in his pocket. And cause I got off the bus to go see him and he had a pipe in his pocket. And I remember thinking like, man, I'm doing so well. Like I'm not affected by this at all. You know, like this doesn't bother me at all. But within 2 days of talking to him and seeing that pipe, I was high, you know, I was high with him. I left my sober living in the middle of the night. And interestingly, I only stayed out for about 2 weeks and about 2 weeks. And then I got clean and I've been clean ever since. And I'm so grateful for all, every single one of those experiences that I talked about, because I had a really hard time surrendering. I had a really hard time recognizing that I had no, that I didn't know how to run my life. You know, like I kept looking back at things, like I'd have these moments of like sort of success, you know, where I'd like keep a job for a little while or have an apartment or, you know, and I would like grab a hold of those as like, I know what I'm doing. I, you know, I need help, but not that much help. And I think what really helped me stay clean this time is a complete and total clarity and understanding after that very last time of like, I am screwed. You know, I do not know how to live. It was one of the most freeing things ever to be able to just acknowledge that, you know. And I think it's important for me to be really mindful of the fact that now that I've been clean a little while, that I still don't know how to live, you know, that I still need help and that I still need to acknowledge this power greater than myself that that brought me to the life that I have today. You know, I don't have any delusions that like I did any of this really. But I do remember in the very last treatment center I was in, having this weird epiphany, like, I'm responsible for my life, not my dad, not my friends, not whoever, you know, random boyfriend, whoever. I always put the responsibility of everything onto other people, you know, and I didn't take any responsibility for my own life. And it was a really freeing moment for me to really know that, like, yeah, I mean, I'm really, I have no idea where I'm going to go. I have no idea what I'm going to do after this, but like, I'm responsible for it, you know? And I really just checked out. I didn't talk to my family for 8 months and I stayed pretty immersed. I was fortunate to be, able to live in steps 1, 2, and 3 for 8 or 9 months. I was a person that needed to be in a longer situation, you know. I really did. I was, and I'm grateful for that. You know, I really needed enough time to just like unpack what had gone on for the last 20 years. So I got out of, I left that place and I moved into another sober living and I started from scratch, you know, and it, I remember people would come into treatment centers I was in, specifically like this alumni meeting. There's this woman, I still see her today, and we laugh about the fact that she would come in and she had like jewelry on. And I never forget that. I remember thinking like, how does she still have any of that stuff? You know, like how does she have like things on her fingers and a wallet, you know, like I had, like that stuff was all gone for me. And I remember mourning it. Like, I remember when I had all that stuff, you know, like I just, I needed to hear that there was a way out, you know, that there was, that you could go down this far and I know there's further to go. Right. But like, for me, the emotional, you know, sitting at the bus stop with everything I own, you know, there's so many like flashbacks. Whenever I drive up 183 to go to a meeting I go to on Saturday nights, I drive past all those motels that I stayed in, you know, and it all comes like flooding back to me, like what was going on at that time. And just like that sad girl walking around aimlessly talking to herself, you know, with her dog, that's where I was at, you know, and it, and I don't like say that, I say that like with, not with compassion for that girl, you know what I mean? And gratitude that, that I'm in the place that I'm in now. And like, it just seems, it seems hard to, you know, hard to believe, but at the same time, like it's made me such a believer in the process of the steps. So I'll talk a little bit about my experience with the program. And, you know, I'm a little, I guess, unorthodox. I don't know. In that, I don't even like the language working the steps, really. You know, I like the idea, and what really helped me, because I felt like I had already done AA for all those years. You know, I felt like I had already tried it and it didn't work. And so I needed to have like a different experience with that. And what that looked like for me was integrating the steps, integrating surrender, integrating, you know, coming to believe, integrating making a decision to turn my will and my life over, like all moments throughout the day in this, like, in this, it started in that place, this community that I lived in, where, you know, everything was like a, everything was some kind of lesson, you know, and it really, really changed my perspective, and changed my life, honestly. So yeah, I mean, that's my take on it. I don't work a perfect program, and sometimes I judge myself for that, you know, like I should be doing it like this, or I should be doing it like that. And, you know, I try to like stay away from that stuff. You know, I really do. Like I'm striving to learn more. I'm striving for, to be better. I'm taught things all the time about ways that I can improve. I've had the same sponsor for, I've had her longer than 4.5. Well, I guess 4.5 years, right? I've had the same sponsor, for a long time. And, the conversations that we have grown, you know, in the beginning, it was like, I want to quit this job. And she'd be like, would you, you know, like trying to not convince me. She's never actually told me what to do. She just suggests that I might want to try to stay there for a little while, you know, like just, why don't you just try to stay? This is right when I got out and was living in sober living, or I'd call her and be like, I hate this girl in sober living. And, you know, like those kinds of things. So it's changed, you know, now the conversations, the character defects and the struggles that I have are different. It's like, it's just the quality of my problems have changed, you know, but like the stuff, the underlying stuff is still the same, You know, it's still, now I struggle with like self-worth and, you know, boundaries and just variety of things. Like I said, the quality of my problems has definitely improved drastically. So yeah, I mean, I love the life that I'm living now. I, you know, went from being like a homeless meth addict stealing your Amazon packages to like legitimately stealing your Amazon packages. That was my thing for a while. Thank God they didn't have those Ring doorbells back then, man. I would have been in trouble. But yeah, that's how I supported my habit at the very end. So I went from that to, you know, I'm in school. I have a full-time job. I've been at my job for three years. Yeah, a little over 3 years. That's unheard of for me, you know, and I show up every day, which is just shocking, you know, and I don't even want to not show up. That's the even more shocking part. You know, I've never woken up and tried to convince myself not to go in, you know, and that's, I mean, that was my thing. You know, I could not show up at all. And I think the program taught me that, showing up for things like this tonight, which I totally forgot about, you know, and Chris sent me a reminder, and it's just like an instinct of like, you know, trying to follow through. That was another big thing, is integrity. You know, just trying to follow through on the things that I commit to, and I'm not perfect at it at all. But it is something that I'm mindful of. You know, like there were so many people that went before me that showed up for me, you know, and I really do try to honor that as well. So I'm extremely grateful that I made it out alive. You know, I'm so thankful that that there were people there that you know, were patient with me. And you know, I didn't even realize that I was in delusion. You know, like I my little brain couldn't handle that. You know, like if someone had told me the whole truth about my situation and myself, I don't think I could have handled it. So people were really gentle with me. And I'm really grateful for that. Grateful to Austin Recovery. And I really appreciate you guys listening to me tonight. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Becca. That was rad.
Hearing your story.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks, Sergio.
Yeah, congrats, Bill. That's awesome, man. 10 months.